Here's why you need to attend the Recruitment Coach Live Summit in London this September. Reason number one is networking. The opportunity to connect in person with like-minded recruitment business owners and share strategies and best practices. Of course, you can do that via Zoom or Teams, but the connection is deeper when you do it in real life. Wouldn't you agree? One of our previous attendees, Darcy, said that she loved the speakers and the content, but the best part for her was in between the sessions, the informal conversations with other successful business owners that sparked incredible insights and those aha moments. The quality of people in the room will be incredible, including many of the people you've heard me interview on this podcast. There's going to be big billing recruiters as well as business owners with multi-million pound businesses. What they all have in common is that they prioritize their own development. And no matter how successful they already are, they want to keep learning and growing. What's even more special and remarkable about this group is that they're all willing to share their knowledge and they're so generous at helping each other improve. Early bird pricing is still available. Register now by visiting recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby, and I'm very happy to be joined today by Fernando Espinosa. Fernando is the president of Sanford Rose Associates International Franchise for San Diego, Mexico, and LATAM, as well as the CEO of Top Notch Finders. With over three decades of excellence in the field, Fernando's firm recruits top-tier executives for manufacturing sites in Mexico, LATAM, and the U.S. He also has expertise in executive roles across Europe, Asia, and the Americas. Fernando has been a member of the Pinnacle Society since 2007. As many of our listeners know, Pinnacle are a collective of the top 80 headhunters in North America. I recently learned that in addition to speaking English and Spanish, Fernando is also fluent in Japanese and French. Fernando, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Mark. Thank you so much
for
having me.
We met for the first time in April at the Pinnacle Society Conference in San Diego, which is where you live, right? Awesome.
Yes,
and
correct.
So I really, really enjoyed connecting with you there. And so many people told me, Fernando is one you have to have on the podcast. Other Pinnacle members were saying he's like the one to get on the podcast. So I'm honored that you agreed to do it.
Thank you so much.
All right, fantastic. So I'm always like to hear people's backstory. Like, how did you get into the recruiting industry in the first place, Fernando?
Well, I wish I can tell you, oh, it was something really prepared. That was part of my life plan and my career plan. No, it wasn't. I started international relations in Mexico City, and one of my purpose and my goals in life was to learn Japanese and get immersed into the Japanese culture. So I got a scholarship to do a master's degree in Japan, and unfortunately, even though I live in Japan and I studied in Japan, I wasn't able to finish my master's degree in Japan. I had to come back to Mexico and do it in Mexico. But when I came back from Japan, a recruiter hired me to be like a translator for Japanese companies floating the Mexican border region with electronics manufacturing sites, the Sonys, Casios, Matsushitas, Panasonics of the world were floating the border region, wanted to take advantage of NAFTA. So I started like as a translator, and then I evolved into a recruiter in 2 months. Like, okay, no, you got to help us finding all these experts in surface mount technology and TV manufacturing sets and all kinds of electronics from other regions in Mexico to move to the border region and then starting those big manufacturing sites.
All right.
So it was an accident.
That's interesting.
Really.
So actually, you were hired because your language skills, but then so what was it in those early days that let you know and let the company know that actually, no, you belong, you would be great as a recruiter?
I think that the fact that naturally I am a curious person, and I wanted to help those companies, and I wanted to help those people joining those companies, because there wasn't many people involved in Japanese manufacturing sites. There was a big cultural and language barrier between the people coming from Japan, people from other U.S. sites moving also to the border region, and Mexican nationals all wanted to work together but not knowing how. So we got we became like a bridge in a cross-cultural approach, understanding each other's ideas of leadership, problem solving, decision making, teamwork, and getting to a dynamic of trying to make those factories being successful by getting to know each other, understanding each other, and helping each other.
Love that. That's a great answer. So at what point did you decide to launch your own firm, Top-Notch Finders, Fernando?
Yes, I was a recruiter for another firm in Tijuana, mm-hmm. Mexico, for about 5 years. And then I was able to place maybe about 30 to 40 people on a monthly basis. Whoa. By myself. The owner of the firm wasn't really involved in recruiting. He was more like the business development piece of the business. And I was the only recruiter. So he was like, okay, we need to hire more recruiters. And you're going to be managing those recruiters. I didn't know how to manage, not even myself. So I had to learn on the spot, had to not just coach, mentor, and develop people, but also my own managing style, if I had any, and how to help those people to be successful as recruiters. So throughout the 4 or 5 years that I was director of recruiting, I started to develop certain skills and abilities to develop relationships with those people, understanding those people, helping those people, and at the same time helping myself to become a better manager and a better director. So when I realized that I had the tool set, and I had developed the tool set to become a business owner, I thought I was ready to set up my own shop, and that's what I did in
1999. Okay, wow. Fernando, I just want to go back. You kind of skimmed over something that blew my mind. How is it even possible to place 30 to 40 people per month? That the logistics of that alone, that boggles my mind.
Yes, the Japanese companies were in big need of not just executives, because when I started, I wasn't recruiting only. Actually, I wasn't even recruiting big level mm-hmm. executives, just individual contributor recruiter people for companies. So planners, engineers, all kinds of different HR experts and finance people on individual contributor roles. So the companies were like, okay, we need 30 people for this month, and we need them tomorrow. And, okay, so back on those days, there was no internet. There was no, I'm talking about 30 years ago, there was no actual email. It was everything through fax, and we had a Rolodex, or we built a Rolodex. And the way that we did it was, I went to the manufacturing sites in electronics for American companies, and looking for all the people that I could find in restaurants and places, and where I can get to talk to people and get to recommend me people, like old-fashioned headhunting, talking and developing relationships with people that became informers of, okay, who is who and where is everybody and how I can get a contact with other people. And as a result of that, we started to place a lot of individual contributors. It wasn't retain or engage search process. It was 100% contingency. And on contingency, there was no long list or short list and deep, thorough research process presenting high-caliber professionals. No, It was like just, oh, I get to know this Costa Canton. Hey, you have your resume. Give it to me. I'll send it by fax to my client. And then that way, I was like a machine of producing resumes, sending people to all these manufacturing sites. And by placing 5 to 10 people to all the different manufacturing sites, we were able to place over 30 people on a monthly basis. So I was really, really, really good in finding all those people and sending them to these companies. And then I started to develop other abilities to reach out to companies in other regions in Mexico by phone, and then and through the fax, getting the resumes and presenting them. And so that way we increase the pool of candidates for those companies.
Incredible. It's funny. I started in the late 90s in recruiting. It was still sending faxes, even sending resumes in the mail. We call them CVs, but same thing, sending them in the mail. But the mail is slower, so you also would fax it just to make sure, you know, so you'd send it two different ways because you didn't want, especially in contingency, you don't want your competitor to get the CV to the customer first, right? So it was a bit of a, yeah, it's hilarious. In fact, I remember there being a lineup at the fax machine because we only had one fax machine, but there was like 8 recruiters in my office. And we're all like waiting our turn to send those resumes by fax. But Fernando, you must have been incredibly efficient because even if you're working, you're placing 5 to 10 people per week. I'm just trying to work that. That's like almost a placement per day, or maybe it's more than a placement per day, right?
Yes, actually, yes. And I was able to send not just one individual because, you know, companies won't settle with just one people. I had to send 4 or 5 people for every job. So I had to the advantage of that is that there was so much need for the companies to hire all these individuals. Their screening process, their evaluation process was very fast and wasn't that complicated because they really wanted to use the mirror strategy. No. You know the mirror? You put a mirror in front of you. If you breathe and you can see the breathe, oh, you're alive, you're gone, you're hired. Boom.
I get it.
So it wasn't really a sophisticated process where people get hired because of their emotional intelligence and technical competence and skills. No, it was more like, okay, you are a CASA content, we need a CASA content. Oh, you are an engineer, an industrial engineer. Okay, we train you. Boom.
That was like that.
Very, very needed basis.
It underscores how important motivation is. Like if a company is an employer is really motivated, like if they're desperate for that talent in order to make sure their production, their manufacturing plant is actually operating and they're getting product out, they will move fast, right? And you know, that's what we want. Now, obviously, these days, it's more rigorous. There's more, you know, selection. There's more culture fit, all this stuff. But having said that, we still want to work with buyers who have a sense of urgency, right? And who will expedite the process. They're not going to take 8 interviews over the course of 2 months to make a decision.
And you have to remember, we're talking about NAFTA years. So those companies were already committed to deliver X number of TV sets monthly basis. Yes, they had to produce the TV sets, radios, video components, refrigerators. They had to produce it yesterday. They had to get all the production out. And they had this cultural misfit because many of these people didn't speak English or Spanish. They spoke Japanese only. And they were having a lot of trouble communicating with people. So we had to help them also onboarding the people and pretty much help them getting acquainted into the process and the way they do things and the way they work. So it was very challenging because some of the people that we helped them hire, 5 weeks after being hired, they were like, okay, I'm leaving this company. I don't understand their way they work and how they process things and how they want things to get done. So I'm out of here. So I had, no, you can't leave because I had, there's a warranty. You got to be there at least 1 year. And you need to stay. So we had to develop this cross-cultural bridges with these people so they can understand the dynamics of how to work in a Japanese company in the boardroom.
This is so cool, Fernando, because what you're talking about is a really, this is a differentiator, right? There can't be very many other recruiters who spoke English, Spanish, and Japanese. That was like your unique selling proposition that would make you extremely valuable to those companies.
Well, I had to be 100% honest with you, Mark. I thought I spoke English.
Okay.
I moved from Mexico City to the border region, and I realized that I didn't know how to communicate in English. My accent was even thicker than today. My line of thinking was affected by translating what I was thinking. And I couldn't communicate as efficiently as I wanted in English. It was better for me to communicate in Japanese because I don't know if you know this, but Spanish has many similar sounds that a Japanese.
I did not know that.
So the basics of the communications, the sounds and the accent is very, very similar. So it wasn't hard for me to say a word in Japanese. It was way harder to say it in English.
Wow, that does surprise me. I didn't know that. So how did you overcome that challenge?
Yeah. Practicing. I had to go through role-playing on a daily basis every morning and every night before I went to work. I will practice a conversation with a cost accountant, with an engineer, with a planner, with a buyer, because they were going to be interviewed by a Japanese guy in English. And the Japanese guys had their big accent. And the Mexican guys had, like myself, big accent. And they couldn't understand each other. So I had to make sure that the people that I presented were good enough sharing their thoughts in English and they could be understood. And I had to be ready to screen that. And I didn't know how to, so I had to practice it. I had to practice and practice and practice. And then by the time I developed certain practice, I was able to at least secure some basic thoughts and ideas and feeling those people that they could communicate the most basic skills and competencies to the Japanese.
Amazing. I love that story. How long did it take you before you achieved fluency in English?
That I feel 100% comfortable? Not yet.
Not yet, even. Wow. But you live.
I'm still a work process.
Well, you're being very self-critical because you seem very fluent and articulate to me. And you live in San Diego, right? So you must, you obviously, I think you're being modest. But listen, so from those days, you had that was an incredible experience. Then you realized that you had developed these skills to lead, to train, to mentor people. So 1999, you launched your current business. Is that right? No. Okay.
No. In 1999, I make a partnership with an American guy, and I decide to leave my previous company as a recruiter and become an entrepreneur. I thought I was a businessman. Of course, you know better than anybody else. To be a successful recruiter doesn't mean you can become a business owner. I didn't have a clue how to run a business. I knew how to place lots of people, but I didn't know how to run a business. I didn't have a clue about business development, didn't know anything about admin, didn't know anything about SOPs, didn't know a thing about marketing, and so on and so forth, finance. So started my own business with this American citizen, and we created those two operations, one in Mexico, in Tijuana, and one in San Diego. He was running the San Diego side. I was running the Mexican side. And we were like that for about 12 years. We were very successful in developing the business from a two-man show into a 20-people operation where I was running all the operations. He was running the business development and administration side of the business, finance. So am I thinking that we were successful because we became a $6 million company when before we didn't even know how to run a business? So from that standard, from that perspective, I believe that we were very successful. We weren't successful as business owners because we had to hire so many people to cover for our areas of opportunity. We didn't know anything about finance, so we had a director of finance. We didn't know anything about HR. We hired a HR manager. And we didn't know about business development. We hired a director of business development. So all the areas that we didn't really know, we had to hire better professionals to run those areas. And that was pretty good until a big crisis came in 2009 with the big fallout of the economy. And then we went from $6 million to about $500,000 in sales. So we had to let go many people. It was a brutal experience. We felt like we had imposter syndrome because we weren't what we thought we were.
Yeah, I think a lot.
And unfortunately, that created a big rupture in the relationship with my partner, and we have to part ways. So as a result of that, I started my own solo shop all by myself, nobody else, no recruiters, no people whatsoever. And I was like that from 2012 to 2016, 4 years as a solo recruiter. I thought that people knew me in the market, that people will be so happy to deal with me on a daily basis that I forgot that it's not just about who you are and your reputation, but also understanding that the market evolves and changes. And there weren't the days where people will recommend you word of mouth. The internet was taking over. Everybody was communicating with companies through the purchasing departments and finance departments and talent acquisition and human resources, not just the hiring manager calling you to say, hey, look for a plant manager for my site in Mexico. No, the dynamic changed. The whole business changed and evolved, and I had to start all over again. Like I didn't have any expertise in recruiting, didn't have any expertise in placing people. And, of course, also the limiting beliefs. When you have limiting beliefs and you don't know that you have limiting beliefs, that affects your ability to reinvent yourself, to create a better version of yourself. And I had tons of limiting beliefs, self-limiting beliefs. So I always thought that I could never help a company hire anybody in other countries rather than only Mexico. I always thought that I never could do retain search or engage search. I always thought that I will never do a global assignment. I had so many limiting beliefs that I can spend the whole podcast telling you all my limiting beliefs. And I had to overcome all of that because nobody can help you to eliminate your self-limiting beliefs,
right,
but yourself. So I had to work a lot on introspection and also eliminating procrastination. That's still a working process. But I had to reinvent myself in a way that I take advantage of all the competencies that I have built throughout the years, and at the same time also improving myself in many different ways on a daily
Fernando,
basis.
Let me just pause there because, first of all, I really appreciate your being so open about, you know, your strengths and limitations. And The fact is, every single human being has limiting beliefs. And as you have identified, the biggest challenge is that we usually don't know what they are. We have a blind spot. It's hard to be aware of your own limiting beliefs because that's the nature of belief. You know, when you believe something is the case or isn't the case, then to you, that seems like a fact. Your brain just accepts it. And then that's the filter that you perceive the world in. And it's like, you know, Tony Robbins has his success cycle where you have like, you know, we all have a huge amount of potential, but your beliefs determine how much of your potential you get access to, right? Which in turn affects the quantity and quality of action that you take, which then leads to the results, the quality of results that you experience, good or bad, which then reinforces the original belief. And that can work in a positive direction, and it can also work against you in a negative direction, right? So the example you gave, like, I don't believe that, I hear this a lot. In my market, clients would not accept or retain, you know, they only work contingent, it won't work for me, right? Now, if you believe that, and to you, you think that is absolutely a fact, then number one, you're probably not even going to try to pitch the retainer, which means automatically it's impossible to win something if you never try. Number two, maybe even if as your coach, I say to somebody, listen, we know that you can sell a retainer in any industry, in any market sector. We have other customers who are successful, so try. Then they might go through the motions of trying, but they still don't believe it. And so they're not as persuasive. They're not as creative. They're not as, you know, they give up too easily. And then so the quality of the action is poor. And then that leads to a poor result. And then they go, see, I told you it's not going to work. Right. So that's the nature of these beliefs. What was your process for, first of all, becoming aware of those beliefs, and secondly, to start replacing those with more positive beliefs?
I wish I can tell you it was the result of a really deep thought process where I evolved into almost meditating expert. No, it was the financial crisis. It was mm-hmm. COVID. There were many different, the separation from my previous partner, many different circumstances that forced me to think outside of the box, to think like, okay, what's happening right now? What I need to do to get out of this bottleneck? I'm in a bottleneck. I understand that I have the potential, but something very deeply is limiting myself to get to accomplish my goals and my dreams. I don't know what it is. I need to realize, I need to understand where all that garbage is coming from and how to substitute and change those ideas into new beliefs, new ideas that will allow me to feel that I empower myself and make sure that I can accomplish those goals. And understanding that, and we're talking March 2020, I had over 15 positions to be placed, candidates that were on the final stages of the final offer. April comes, and all companies say, thank you so much. We're doing a hiring freeze. We're not hiring anybody. It was nice to talk to you. Bye-bye. And what I'm going to do? And I didn't know what to do. I had so many commitments, financial commitments, and so many things to get done. And I didn't have anything on the pipeline to be placed. And I got desperate. And many times, desperation has been my best friend. Okay. Desperation, crisis, has made me more resilient, a better human being, more humble human being. Because when you have reached certain level of success, you tend to believe that the only way to get things done is the way that you have done it throughout the years. And then many times the way you do things is the reason to certain level of success, but also your main limitation to get to a higher level. And by changing those beliefs, by thinking, okay, I never done a search in Massachusetts for a plant manager. I believe that I'm not going to be able to be successful. You were right. I wasn't. Until I had to. There was no other way. You had to be successful or a big crisis going to come knock on your door. So I started developing strategies. Okay, what I'm missing? Candidates? Okay, I have to be better at sourcing. Oh, screening? I had to be better at doing inside interviews. Developing better, stronger relationship with clients. Understanding better my clients from not just the hiring managers, but the HR people, all the people that influence the process. I had to be able to overcome all the barriers that I'm putting myself and then be able to deliver an efficient result to those clients that are giving me a chance. They are giving me a shot. I had to take that shot and make it happen, one way or the other. And that's the way I've been able to accomplish it. I wish I can tell you, oh, it was an SOP process. I map all my processes and put it in place and had all my scripts well done.
Fernando, I can so much relate to you because I've had many crises and, you know, tough times as well in my business. And it's horrible when you're going through that. But it also forces you to evolve, to get better, to do things differently, because what you were doing before stopped working. So then you have no choice but to reinvent yourself and try different strategies. So that happened for me during the 2008-2009 recession as well. But then also during COVID. So I think one of my limiting beliefs for a long time, I was just a solo practitioner in this business. And I just believed, because I had a previous experience of managing people and I was not good at it. I was not successful. So that experience made me believe I cannot be a great leader. I'm not good at managing people. I'm better just being, you know, doing my own thing, being responsible for my own results. But that really put a ceiling on how much I could achieve, because one person can only do so much, right? But then during COVID, again, like, because I'd been through a recession before and come out the other side and learned a lot in the process, I wasn't so worried, but it did force me to change some things. And one of the things that I decided to change was to grow my team. And that's when I recruited Leanne. And that has been such a positive trajectory that, you know, our business has grown incredibly since then. And if I had stuck to my old beliefs, then that would have never happened. And I would have still been here instead of way up here. But it was the crisis of COVID that forced me to snap out of that and to try something else.
I hear you. I 100% hear you. The motivation that you get from a crisis, I feel is more powerful than the motivation that you get from your successes. Because on your successes, it happens to me that I have the lion syndrome. That belief that, you know, that a lion goes and hunts, eats, and then rests. In recruiting, you do a big placement, you get $200,000 a fee. You're like, okay, I'm going to go sit and enjoy myself and have a nice rest. And you don't do business development. You don't talk to people. You don't get out. You don't expose yourself. You're killing yourself with that syndrome. So I have to switch gears and understand that I needed to keep on going on the business development approach and reaching out to people and working as more as efficient as possible, because at the end of the day, the placements of tomorrow are going to come from the efforts of today.
Yep.
So that realization really helped me understand that it is not just your ability to get a placement done, but your ability to put the seats right on time so you can get the results.
I love that. The lion syndrome. I've not heard that one before. That's a good analogy. So you have since gone on to transition from contingent to retained. Could you talk me through that process?
Yes. Since my approach to recruiting was 100% contingency based, I had a lot of trouble with the limiting beliefs, trying to sell a retain and engage. Sanford Rose came very critical as a great tool to start at least understanding the dynamics of engage and retain search processes. Karen Schmidt, Jeff Kay, and a bunch of people in Sanford Rose do this as part of the franchise, do those training sessions, telling you the mechanics and the dynamics of the retain search and engage projects. And I took advantage of all the trainings. Every training I was signing up, and they were like, you already took this one. I don't care. I want to master it. I want to become a market master of retain and engage their projects. I don't want to feel like I still need to learn something or to understand something to be able to sell those projects. And like you said, no matter how many times I could take those trainings, if you believe that you cannot make it, there is no way that you're going to make it happen. So in one of those sessions, I realized that I was the biggest obstacle.
Yep. That is always, Fernando, that is always the case. People think the obstacle is, the obstacle is the talent acquisition, or it's the purchasing department, or it's the competitors, or market's too saturated, or it's, you know, they see these outside, you know, enemies. But the reality is we are the biggest obstacle to our own success. It's, you know, it's ourselves. That's you're a wise man, Fernando. I think you've figured out a thing or two.
Well, believe me, I had to really do a deep dive in understanding why I wasn't able to. And all I was I'm an expert in victimization. I was like, oh no, he's the client. No, is this HR guy? No, is the hiring manager that doesn't really value my services and they don't understand what I bring to the table? No, it was 100% me. I take ownership on those faults, and I don't have a problem recognizing, because at the end of the day, I was able to understand that, and I'm working on that. And believe me, now I have a 60% success rate in my
retain search. Wow, that's awesome.
Before, I was zero. Nothing. Yeah. None.
Fantastic. 60% ratio is fantastic. So you joined SRA in 2016, I think. Is that right? And so
yes,
then
correct.
That you went through all their training. Jeff and Karen and the team there are fantastic. And then tell me about the very first retained project that you won. Do you remember what it was?
Yes. I got a client that needed to hire an individual contributor role for a $4 billion company with operations in Mexico. This company needed to hire an individual contributor for customs for Mexico because of many changes in the law in Mexico. And they didn't want to work with outside recruiters rather than the ones that they already had in their vendor structure. So I pitch an engaged approach to my client and say, okay, let's do this. Just give me that one individual contributor role and go from there. What what can happen? If you like it, the way I work and everything, we go to the next level position and so on and so forth. So they were desperate to find this customs compliance because they have a big talent acquisition team. They have about 20 people in the organization, and they couldn't find it. And they had 6 months on the search, and they could not find an individual contributor that can get that position filled. I say, okay, I'm going to find it to you in 2 days. I promise. I promise I do it in 2 days, but just give me the chance. Okay, give me $2,000 as an engage fee. No more. $2,000, we make it happen. They gave me the assignment, so I did. I presented 2 candidates on the second day. They interviewed them, and they decided to hire one of them. The compliance director for Mexico was so happy that she decided to give me a director position in customs as well. And we do the same mechanic. Okay, let's do this solo position. We're not going to give you $2,000. We're going to give you $1,000. I'm fine. Give it to me. We do the search, and we place individual in 1 month. She's so happy that she talks to other hiring managers. This guy found me 2 very critical positions in less than 1 month, and this is an amazing recruiter. You need to use it. And then all of a sudden, I got an account that represented $700,000.
Wow, that's incredible.
In the scope of 8 months. So it was after COVID. We're talking 2021. And December 2021. And I was like filling positions left and right. And I started with this individual contributor role. And then it became global positions, VP of SIOP, VP of operations, director of finance, director of operations for positions in Los Angeles or in Michigan or anywhere in London. And all of a sudden, I was like the go-to recruiter.
I love this, Fernando.
Until they got the hiring freeze this year. But, but at the end of the day, those techniques that I learned allow me to don't settle to be like, okay, I want the whole enchilada right from the get-go. I didn't care about getting all the project from the get-go. I didn't even know that they had so many positions open. I just wanted my fit in. Once I get my foot in, I was able to become a business partner for my client, and they can rely on our expertise to get the position.
I love that. So,
but I wish I can tell you, it was a very thorough process where I had to approach this VP of operations position, where I had to go and spend 2 days with the client understanding the position, understanding the challenges and opportunities. No, it wasn't like that. Then I learned about those things, but not in the beginning. It was more like I get to get an engage fee, a $2,000 engage fee for an individual contributor role that that cost them $30,000 to hire this individual. I mean, they paid $30,000 on a yearly basis. There's nothing. But then I was able to place $300,000 positions, $400,000 positions, just the base with them in
amazing
other roles.
I love that story, Fernando. So what my takeaway is, I like the fact that you turned, like they had a talent acquisition team, they had already vendors who they were had approved to work with and so on. And a lot of recruiters give up in that scenario. They just go, oh, okay, I guess I'm not going to get that business, and they move on to something else. But you said, just give me one, like what is something you're really struggling to fill and that nobody else has been able to fill? And so I love that attitude. But also number two, a $2,000 retainer is nothing, right? It's easy for them. Like they don't really risk much, but it is a sign of their commitment. I always think, like, having some money up front almost doesn't matter. Obviously, more is better, but you know, it's more this psychologically, they are committed to working with you, and they're showing that they're serious about hiring by giving you even just $2,000 is better than contingency, you know, for sure. And you turn that into $700K in billings within an 8 month time frame. That is incredible. Well done. That's
I was a happy yeah,
I bet. Absolutely. Do you mind sharing, because I think you're doing extremely well within SRA, like where are you in the leaderboard for the US?
I think at this point throughout the year, I'm in the top 10 of the small offices, because we have offices that are bigger, way yeah. bigger than ours. My office is just me, another recruiter, an interviewer, and a graphic designer and artificial intelligence guys. So in production, it's just me yeah. and another recruiter. So my production goes on a yearly basis around 1 million, 1.2. I'm in the process this year to become maybe 1.4, 1.5. I'm in good shape right now. But I'm about to hire other couple of people, and I have a plan to, in 5 years, become a $6-7 million company. And I want to have maybe about 5 to 10 recruiters working for me, me as a rainmaker, developing a strategy so I can get out of the trenches and get my recruiters getting the job
I
done.
I love that, Fernando. That's you've got a clear vision. You're obviously passionate about it, but you've also got just a fantastic foundation to build on, and you've got a great network with SRA to support you there.
Yes.
I heard there's a story about you filling 500 positions with an RPO project in 1 year. Could you tell that story?
Yes. It was an RPO project that we had with a company in Mexico that they we're talking about years that our space business was started oh. in Mexico. There was no previous investment, because you had to go through all the process of many of those aerospace companies have defense contracts, and they had to go through the motions of being approved by the government to share those technologies outside of the U.S. So Mexico was a recipient of those certificates to have operations in Mexico and then service the U.S. market. We're talking 2006, 2007. And then a big company, a big aerospace company, Honeywell, was moving operations from Canada and the U.S., from Tucson and Phoenix and Canada to Mexico. And they had also a big talent acquisition team, and they needed to get many individual contributor management and director level roles for those sites. They were building centers of excellence to do many activities in the aerospace industry, but mainly repair and overhaul of turbines. That technology didn't exist in Mexico. There was no other turbine repair manufacturing site in Mexico or even in Latin America. So they needed highly qualified experts, engineers, in design, in not just electrical but mechanical design, in all kinds of different manufacturing, industrial, and maintenance engineering, all kinds of sales and operation specialists, and they needed to build these centers of excellence to continue servicing the U.S. market, but through Mexico. And since Mexico was the first time recipient of those technologies, the talent acquisition team couldn't find a single person to fit the profiles that they were looking for. So they reach out to us and they ask us to bid as a recruiter vendor for that project, our RPO project. We started with 150 positions to get filled in a 6-month span. And then everything went crazy. We had to do major blitz events and bringing people from all over Mexico to Mexicali and doing massive interviewing processes where they had to they interview anywhere between 40 to 200 people on a weekly basis to get as many people hired as possible. That experience with the Japanese company helped me a lot because I really knew now we had access to technology, we had databases, now we had access to the internet. LinkedIn wasn't that famous back then, but there were many, many databases with Monster and Career Builder and so on and so forth that we had access to we could create job boards in Mexico and have people applying to those jobs directly online. And as a result, I was able to solo place over 500 people for Honeywell sites in Mexicali, Chihuahua, Monterrey, State of Mexico, and San Luis Potosí, and Tijuana, Juarez. All those sites with different needs, different expectations, different products and processes, because back then, Honeywell was very strong in aerospace, but also in consumer products and also in automotive. They had this transportation structure where they had CPG, they manufacturing CPGs, they were manufacturing turbochargers, thermal products, they were manufacturing stations for boilers and all kinds of different products for retail, residential, and commercial buildings. And so we were able to start with that project and then become into a massive partner, filling positions all over Mexico for Honeywell.
Incredible.
And so I had to hire a bunch of people to help me doing the communication, because we were in charge of all the logistic process of getting people on the planes and flying in into and put them into the hotels, and then coordinating the interviews, and then coordinating the job offer deliveries and negotiating compensation packages and so on and so forth. So the whole process, we were in charge of the whole process. But I, as a recruiter, I had other people, but they couldn't find, they weren't seasoned enough to do the job right. So I had to pretty much take over myself and getting all the positions filled, working from 6 a.m. in the morning all the way to 1 a.m. in the morning on a daily basis throughout 2 years.
That's insane, Fernando. That's, oh, I can't even get my head around that. That just sounds ridiculous, but you pulled it off. You pulled it off. Which, like, looking back, what would you say are the biggest lessons that you've learned that you have now made you the successful recruiter you are today?
I think the biggest one is always to be humble enough, willing enough to learn. To learn about yourself, to learn about your business, to learn about your areas of opportunity, to your areas of improvement, and be able to get the job done, to reduce those areas of opportunity and limiting beliefs, and make them become a competence, make them become an asset for you. Instead of being afraid of ChatGPT, make it your best friend, your best tool, your best effort. Instead of getting afraid of automation and technology, use it to your advantage. I think that I'm a baby boomer, and I'm always willing to learn. I don't care about learning. I'm always willing to learn, and I think that's the major reason to all the limited success that I have had is coming from that willingness and humbleness to learn and to share.
Fernando, you've actually answered my last question, I think, in advance, because we've just recently started working together. You've joined our program. And so what I was about to ask you is, you're someone who's already billing, you know, around $1 million a year. You already have had excellent training with SRA. You're already doing so many things right. Why invest in coaching?
Yes, as I told you, I believe that it is very critical to develop the best version of yourself on a daily basis. When you settle with the version of yourself, you automatically put a stop on your growing and your developing. I always believe that I don't have all the answers. I don't have all the reasons why I can do a thing or two. I always know that there's people with different perspectives, different ideas, different thought processes that I can learn from, that I can enrich myself with. And I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to listen to an expert recruiting coach that have been very successful helping other recruiting owners. I could have used only Sanford Rose. I could have used only Pinnacle because I have amazing resources with Sanford Rose and Pinnacle. It's not that Sanford Rose and Pinnacle don't have all the coaches that I can use to be better. I use them as much as I can. But I also believe that there are other people that bring fresh ideas, new ideas, different ideas. You are in London. You are far, far away from San Diego. And in your perspective, listening to so many recruiting owners, so many recruiting experts, their thought process, the way they work, the way they run their businesses, allows you to be a better coach on a daily basis because you listen to so many good things and bad things that when you have a process in place like you have, when you held your people accountable and make them feel like, okay, you need to get this done and make it happen, and you're hiring me for that, you're hiring me to help you, okay, let me help you.
Absolutely.
The best disposition has to come from you. You have to be willing to be taught. Willing to learn. Otherwise, it is just BS. It is just like, oh, yes, I want to become a better person of myself. And you don't do anything to make it happen.
Fernando, I love your humility. I love your energy and your passion. And really enjoyed this conversation. I'm sure many people will enjoy it as well. But they'll be nodding along because you say so many things that we can all relate to and definitely resonate for me. So that was fun. Thank you, man.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to have this amazing conversation with you. And I really appreciate that you took me as one of the people that you can mentor and coach. And I'm really have big expectations, not just from the recruiting coaching, but also from developing a long-term relationship with you and your team.
Thank you so much, Fernando. Have a great day.
You too.
Thank you for listening to The Resilient Recruiter. I know how busy recruiters are, so I'm honored that you're investing this time with me each week. I don't take your attention for granted. That's why I'm going all out to deliver value for you here, real insights you can apply to improve your business. And if you really want to help me to reach a wider audience and impact more people, please consider leaving the show a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you leave me a review, please reach out and let me know so I can thank you personally. Please hit the subscribe button and I'll see you next time.